Okay, so let's get started. It's really nice to see everyone. It's obviously not the same as being in person. I will say, though, that this allows people who normally wouldn't be able to attend this year tonight, including some very special people, including our wife's grandparents. I welcome them. And, I hope that in the zuchut, in the merit of this learning, hopefully we'll have the opportunity to see each other again in person soon. I miss seeing you all very much. I want to begin. First of all, everyone can hear me. Joe, could you hear me? Okay, great. So I want to first begin by expressing my gratitude to Joe Grobe. This year absolutely would not be happening without him. He's been the driving force behind the Tanakh series from the very beginning. So I thank him for making this year happen. I've enjoyed very much preparing this series, and I thank him for that. I thought it would only be appropriate to dedicate this first year in honor of Joe's sister. And you'll see on the source sheet, Nishma Gitti Grobe Palak, Gittel Barafal Mordechai Cohen, who passed away recently and was an incredibly special person, as I heard at the funeral and from Joe. And so I asked Joe if he'd be willing to share a few words. So Joe, please.
Can hear him.
Okay. The only thing that I wanted to say is when I think about Ruth, I think about Eshet Chayil. I think it's the only place in Tanakh where we actually have an individual referred to as an Eshet Chayil, and that individual is Ruth. And when I think about her and I think about my sister was a true Eshet Chayil. She was a nurse in a NICU for many years. She took care of preemies and of sick babies, and it really takes a special person to do that. A special person like Ruth, a Ruth in her own generation. She helped establish the Bikur Cholim at Staten Island University Hospital. She was just that type of person, a true Eshet Chayil, like the person that we're about to learn about. So thank you, Rabbi Wein, for giving me that credit, but I really give you the credit of starting this series. I may have asked you to do it, but you really got it together. So thank you, and thank everybody for attending.
Okay, thank you very much, Joe. With that, let's get started. So I just want to begin with a few prefatory notes about the series before we really dig in. Each week of the series, we're going to try to address a new chapter and a new theme. The advantage of that is if anyone misses a class or someone wants to join for just one or two, they're certainly welcome. Any information that they missed in a previous one, I'll summarize and make sure to fill in. And so we'll have one shiur on each chapter, and then we'll have a fifth one bringing together all the individual themes we'll develop in the first four prakim. The goal is to finish this by Shavuot. We'll figure out maybe, I don't know if Arthur's here. Arthur, if you're here, you'll have to figure out a virtual way to do a Kiddush Siyum for us. But we'll try to finish by Shavuot, and that should be a nice way to celebrate the holiday. I think that because we're going to be moving at a quick pace, we're not going to see every pasuk, every verse inside naturally. But that's okay. That's not our goal. Our goal is to try to develop some of the main and central themes of the book. And I think with the time we'll allot for this, we'll be more than capable of doing so. And I encourage you, if you have the opportunity to sort of fill in, if you just to spend 2-3 minutes just reading the rest of the chapter yourself, or even beforehand, if you have the opportunity to take a glance at the chapter before we address it, that would be great. Not obligatory at all, but if you have the opportunity, that would be, I think, beneficial for you very much. Additionally, we only have 45 minutes this year. We're not going to address everything, but I'd love to continue the conversation afterwards over the phone, via email, and I'm definitely open to discussing issues that we don't address here or further addressing issues that we have discussed in the shiur. Now, two more preparatory notes. One more, one technical one. The medium of Zoom, so certainly teaching for me over Zoom is a new experience. And I'm sure for many of you, learning over Zoom as well is a little bit of a new experience. I can say that quite confidently. So we'll have to see exactly how it works and what the best way to do this is. I'd love for people to participate, a little bit. And I love for there to be interaction. I view this as somewhat of a group, not just a frontal lecture. I also will be trying to use the screen share mode. Hopefully people will be able to see it on their whatever device they're using so we can look at some of the sources together. And I very much appreciate feedback about both the technical things of Zoom and just the general direction of the share. That'd be very helpful for me just in terms of figuring out how we want to proceed in the future. Okay, now let's dig in a little bit. Our goal when we study the Sefer Rut is going to be to try to have a close literary reading of the chapters. We're going to do this through looking out for key themes, to look out for parallels between Rut and other books in Tanakh, and also to utilize modern scholarship and traditional commentaries. So what I mean by traditional commentaries, I mean the classic Rashi, Ibn Ezra, commentaries we'll find in the Nach, and also the Midrashim. Midrashim are often kind of surprising. Some of the things they say appear to be totally unrelated to the text, but if you actually really understand them, very often they're providing a lot of deep insight into what's going on in the text itself, so we'll take advantage of Midrashim too. And in terms of modern scholarship, we'll use a little bit of academia. I've benefited a lot from a couple of books, one of them being Dr. Yael Ziegler's book on Rut. It's about a 470-page volume. I'm 400 pages into it. It's over 100 pages per chapter, which is immense. But I've benefited a lot from that book. I actually had the opportunity to take her course when I was at Yeshiva Har Tzion and take a few of her courses and hear a few shiurim from her on Rut. And we'll definitely incorporate some of that material into here, including today, and also from conversations with my Rebbe, Rabbi Shalom Carmi. Now, issues that often come up when studying Rut in other contexts will be how to date the Book of Rut, when was it actually canonized, structure of Rut. In terms of as a literary work, Rut is brilliantly organized in terms of how the chapters break up. It's phenomenal. But we won't be studying that just for itself. We'll also not be studying Midrash just for the sake of Midrash. And then we'll see. I'm open to exploring this a little more if people are interested. But there's a lot of issues in Rut which kind of relate to halacha, but aren't clearly halachic. And there's a lot of variation between, let's say, the normative halacha, which we practice and which we see in the Torah, versus what actually manifests in Rut. And so there's a lot of differences there. So I'm not intending on focusing on that. If people are interested, please reach out and let me know. And I'm happy to maybe explore that a little bit in some of the later shiurim. All right. And last thing is I put in the chat a link. Yeah, I'll do it just one more time in case people were in here. A link to the source sheet. If you want to look at the source sheet on your own computer or your own device, you're more than welcome to. If not, I'm going to start employing the share screen mode in just a moment. Okay, we're good. Everyone should feel free to unmute themselves if they have any suggestions or questions. Then to also feel free to mute themselves afterwards if they please can, so as to ensure we all hear each other. Okay, good. Let's begin by taking a look at the most famous midrash on Sefer Rut. Can everyone see my screen here? Yeah? Okay, good. All right, so let's take a look here. The first midrash in source number one is probably anybody's ever learned Rut in middle school. They learned this midrash. And I think it's actually much more complex than we usually think of it. The question in the midrash is basically, what is the purpose of this book? But we have to look at how the question is formulated and also how it's answered. Now let's be precise. So if we begin to say Amar Rabbi Zera says Megillah zu ein ba lo tuma velo tahara velo iser velo hater. If you look at this Megillah, this book, there's no halacha, there's no laws of impurity or purity. Velo iser velo hater, there are no laws about what's permissible, what's impermissible. We have none of that. And so therefore, why is it written? Who, you know, why is this an important book for us? Now, at face value, that question is sort of absurd, right? One, if you think about it, it happens to be that there's no book of the five Megillot that has more halacha than Megillat Rut. It's so in terms of attacking a book of the Megillah for not having enough halachic cases or categories, Megillat Rut is not really a fair target. We learn, for example, by Nisuin at weddings, you need to have 10 men there. We learn that from Megillat Rut. We learn about a certain type of acquisition from Megillat Rut. So there's definitely what to learn from Megillat Rut in terms of laws. So it's a little surprising that that's the attack. But what's also interesting is they feel a need, b'lama nichteva. Why is it actually written? What's the purpose of this book? That's a very surprising question. We don't have that by Sefer Bereishit. We don't have that by Sefer Shemot. We don't have that for many books in Nevi'im and Ketuvim. So why are they attacking Rut? Why is Rut getting singled out here? Now, we do have questions by other books of Tanakh, such as by Shir HaShirim and Kohelet, whether they should have been canonized at all. There are cases of that. So it's not that there's no case of a book being challenged whether or not it should be in Tanakh. But in terms of just, we read this book and we don't really understand what the purpose of it is. Why is it in our canon? And I think the question is fair to some extent, because when you read the book of Rut, what are you reading? You're reading the book of one family about one woman who lost her husband and her two sons. And then her daughter-in-law goes with her to her town. She finds a mate and they get married. And in the end, you know, they have a son, a grandson who's a king. But when you read that story, it doesn't really seem to be so important in terms of broader national issues, right? It's about one family. We don't even really know why exactly that family is so important for almost all of the story. And if you're just reading it, why exactly is this here? And so that's the question of the Midrash. We'll address what exactly the question means in just a second. So it says, what's the answer? So we're all familiar with the answer. We say, so usually we think of this. What does it mean? To teach us the importance of doing chesed, of doing acts of kindness. Pretty safe answer, right? Kindness is a good thing. But if you think about it, it's actually pretty surprising what it's saying. If it's all about teaching the importance of the acts of kindness, do I need Megillat Rut to teach me this? Right, where else can I derive, and here, if anyone wants to jump in, where else can I derive that acts of kindness are important besides for Megillat Rut? Are there any other cases we could, any other cases where we could say, hey, you know what, kindness is important? Anybody have any suggestions?
Avraham,
right? Avraham Avinu. Very, very clear example. Avraham Avinu has guests over. He treats them lovely. He provides them with food, with rest. So Avraham Avinu teaches us about chesed. We know if there's one person who has a characteristic of chesed, of kindness, it's Avraham Avinu. Who else? Joe, I'll stick with you. Who else has a characteristic of kindness? So go, what about his daughter-in-law? Right? How does Rivka get connected to Yitzchak? What does Rivka do? Rivka is found at the well, and she provides water for the camels. So Asher lo azav chasov amitom im Adoni, the reason why Eliezer brings Rivka back to Yitzchak and to Avraham is because he's seen her chesed. He's seen her acts of kindness. Now, then we run into a problem, because if we already know about kindness, then why do we need Megillat Rut? And I'll one up the question. Who else is described as kind? Not a human being, but God himself. On Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, how many times do we chant that Chan Rav Chesed V'Emes, Otzer Chesed La'alafim? How much do we talk about God being a source of kindness to everyone? So Avraham's kind, Rivka's kind, God is kind. We need Rut to teach us this? So one answer to this question is, if we read this Midrash a little bit more closely, we could see that it's not exactly the way we said it before, because it doesn't say to teach you the importance of doing chesed. It teaches you how much reward, kama sachar tov, how much reward you get for doing chesed. Now, this is a little bit different, because we could say, oh, Avram and Rivka, maybe we can't talk about their reward, but we could talk about the reward of Ruth, who has a king descend from her, and to have redemption. Now, I think maybe you'd agree with me if I said that. I don't find that so compelling, although it is an answer suggested by quite a few scholars, because Avramun Goyim, Avram Avinu is the leader of all nations. He's our forefather. And then Rivka marries Yitzchak, right? So Rivka doesn't have a type of reward as well. That's why I think this midrash is questionable a little bit. I think the answer to the midrash of reading it that way is questionable, because there's plenty of reward for Avram and Rivka. Avram, the leader of all nations, Rivka, plenty of chesed. She gets to marry Yitzchak because of chesed. So what does this really mean? So here I'd like to turn to a suggestion from my teacher, Dr. Yael Ziegler, which I think is very important. I think will set the stage a little bit for the rest of the book. When you think about the type of chesed we're talking about here, can we compare it to the type of kindness that Avram and Rivka performs, or is Rut a unique type of kindness? So if you think about it for just one moment, let's think about what acts of kindness Rut does. We'll go through one from each chapter. In the first chapter, what does Rut do? Rut abandons her homeland. Rut leaves her source of comfort. She goes with Naomi, even though she likely knows that she's not going to get married. Okay, we know later on that she gets married. But if you're a reader reading just the first chapter without knowing anything else, it's very likely Rut is not going to get married. She's a Moabite going to a Jewish community. So she abandons her safe space. She goes with Naomi purely out of an act of chesed, knowing that she's not going to get married, knowing she's going to die with her, knowing that she might not have a place to sleep at night. Second chapter, what does Rut do? Rut goes to the field and acts like a pauper. And as we'll see later on, Rut actually is in danger there because all the boys are going and trying to grope Rut in the field. So she's acting as a pauper. She goes to glean in the fields and she's at risk there. But yet Rut does it. In the third chapter, what does Rut do? Rut goes to Boaz's grain house and she goes there and she has to act in this seductive, promiscuous way, at least seemingly, which is totally incoherent with the identity Ruth is trying to demonstrate, her new identity as no longer as a Moabite. And finally, and I think this is the most dramatic example, what does Ruth do with her kid that's eventually born to her and Boaz? Anybody know what happens to that kid? Who ends up holding on to it?
Naomi,
exactly. Right? Ruth gives that baby to Naomi, right? And all the people call it Naomi's kid. So if you think about that type of chesed, is that the type of chesed, a normal type of chesed, right? The type that we would normally say, hey, you should do that type. Or does this seem to you a little bit extreme, right? A type of chesed that's so self-nullifying, so costly to oneself, that we would say, wow, Ruth's amazing, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to my own, daughter. Right? Would you recommend to someone to give up their own child to someone else to fulfill the desires of, Naomi? So Ruth gives up her own kid to Naomi, right? Can you think about how crazy that is? But that's kindness, but it's a little bit of an extreme. It's more than we would think to do ourselves and probably wouldn't prescribe it for others. And so I ask you, why is this type of kindness being prescribed here by Ruth? Or maybe it isn't. And so I'd like to share with you an idea from Dr. Ziegler that I think is unbelievable. I'll just share with you a second midrash. If you look at the source sheet here, the Zohar. I don't usually quote Zohars, but this is a great Zohar. Zohar says the following. Am Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, source number 3. Tamiya ani, in Megillah zulo ba el kidei. I wouldn't be surprised if this Megillah did not come el kidei, rather in order to liyachi zera David. It's only here. What's the whole purpose of this Megillah? Just to trace the genealogy of David. And Ibn Ezra, famous commentary in source number 4, basically says the same thing. The purpose of this book is to trace the genealogy of David. Now, that's a little surprising, right, to have a whole book just for that purpose. I think we'd all agree with that. But Dr. Ziegler suggests something fascinating. She says you actually have to combine the two Midrashim and these two themes. And even if you're just a reader of Megillah Rut, this makes a lot of sense, because if you look at Megillah Rut, it begins with it ends with David. It's clear that it's trying to build up to that point. But she said that, what type of chesed are we talking about? We're not talking about a chesed here, a chesed, a kindness of a normal layperson. We're talking about the type of kindness for a king, for a David HaMelech, for the house of David. That's what the Megillah is trying to develop here, how a leader should act. And the point of the Megillah is to teach how a king, which is going to be the next stage in Jewish history, how that king is supposed to act to the people around him. And that's supposed to be in a very self-nullifying manner. It's supposed to be in a manner where I'm not here as the king to serve myself. I'm purely here to serve on behalf of others. That's what a king is supposed to do. Now, the notion of kingship in Judaism is very complicated, but the predominant view is that we're expected to have a king. And in source number 5, Sefer Shoftim, it's clear at the end of Sefer Shoftim, this is the last verse, that you're supposed, that it's time to have a king. I mean, my name ain't mouth be Israel. There's no, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Yishai Yishar Beinav Yaseh. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Everybody, it was anarchy, right? Everyone could just do whatever they wanted. And it's clear at the end of Sefer Shoftim, we need a king. But what's the problem with having a king? If you have a king, as Lord Acton says, source number 6, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. When you have a king, right, they have absolute control and power, that can lead to a lot of corruption, right? Naturally, that's what happens. And so what Judaism tries to do is tries to express how you hold a king back from getting to that point of absolute power, from getting to be corrupt. We know by kings in general, a king can't have too many wives, king can't have too many horses, a king has to have a sefer Torah with him at all times. Because the point is, a king has to not levilti rum levavo me'achav. He can't become too arrogant. He needs to be a person of the people who cares about the people. He needs to be someone who comes from root, someone who has a type of kindness that's self-nullifying, that's only serving on behalf of others. Now, I wouldn't say I should be acting like that. I wouldn't say my daughter should be acting like that or someone else. But a king needs to have that type of kindness. And root is supposed to be the transition from a time of shoftim, a time of just individual judges, individual leaders, to a time of kingship. And so this book is teaching us what the model for a wonderful king is supposed to be. And David HaMelech, the new king, is supposed to be, from root, because otherwise it wouldn't be appropriate for Judaism to appoint a king. It has to be from someone who practices loving kindness in such a way. There's one proof for this. If you look at the end of the book, what do they call Root's son? Batikra'ena Shemo Oved, right? They named him Oved. What is Oved? Oved means working on behalf of others, right? When they name their kid, it's precisely this midah, this character trait, that they're trying to impart to their descendants. Okay, so that's the first midrash. That's the famous midrash. I think we've addressed it at length. But I'd like to actually dig in now. Let's begin with the very, very beginning of Sefer Rut. And I just want to read this pasuk together with you. Well, we're not going to try to cause trouble, but I think there's going to be a lot of questions which jump out at us. Okay, any questions? No, we're good? Okay, good. All right, let's begin with the first pasuk here in Megillat Rut. Vayhi bimei shvot ha-shoftim, and it came to pass in the days of the shoftim. So already we see something interesting. Vayhi bimei comes up 5 times in the entirety of Tanakh. Each time it comes up in the context of a king. Here, there's no king. So already it's kind of hinting that we're supposed to get to a point where there's a king. It says, bimei shvot ha-shoftim, at the time of the judges. Okay? Now, why doesn't it give us more information than just at the time of the judges? Right? That's all it tells us. Then next, Vayhi ra'av ba'aretz, Vayelech ish mi beit lechem Yehuda. Oh, sorry, I'm not sharing the screen. My apologies. So, Vayhi v'yishvot ha-shoftim, Vayhi ra'av ba'aretz. There was a famine in the land. What type of famine is this? Right? Usually when we talk about famines in Bereshit, we have Ra'av Kabed, a very heavy famine. So this seems to be just a Ra'av, a famine in the land.
Vayelach ish mi beilechem Yehuda, so no name. Why isn't it providing a name for him yet? Lagor b'shtei Moav, to live in Moav. Hu v'ishto shnei banav, him, his wife, and two kids. Okay, so, and then, sorry, let's read the next pasuk as well, and then we get the information. B'shem ha'ish Elimelech, b'shem ishto Naami, so his name is Elimelech, his wife is Naami, his two kids are Machlon v'Chilion, Ephratim beilechem Yehuda, they come from Yehuda, v'ivo shtei Moav v'ayu sham. And they get to Moab, and they live there, okay? Vayam Elimelech, Elimelech then dies. We barely met the guy. All of a sudden, in the, from the first pasuk to the third pasuk, we met Elimelech, now he's dead. Ishna ami, v'tisher hi yushnei banel. And then it's just her and her two sons. Then, v'yisu lehem nashim Moabiyo, those two sons then marry two women. Shem ha'achad Orpa, one of the names is Orpa. V'shem ha'sheni Ruth, and the second is named Ruth. And then they live there how long? 10 years. By Musugam Shnehem, and the two of them die, Machlon Mechilion, so now her two sons die. But Tisheri Shem Yishnei Adal Mesha, and she's bereft of now her husband and her two sons. Okay, let's pause here for a moment. If you look at the first pasuk, so there's a ton here. It's very rich, a lot of questions. Even just from the first pasuk, right? We have by Hivi Mesh Shvod HaShoftim, so where's the king? Because Vayibi made it's always a king. Shvod HaShoftim. So it's telling us, whenever Tanakh tells us of a time period something's from, it's telling us something important. Shoftim plays a role here. The fact that it's in that time period. Vayihi Ra'av Ba'aretz, there was a famine in the land. But what type of Ra'av? Right? Vayelech Ish Nibelecham Yehuda. So there's no names. Everyone worth their salt goes and says, wait, why are there two psukim? Just combine the two psukim. Tell us all the names in the first one. Then it says, Lagor b'shtei Moav, to dwell or to sojourn, as they translate it, b'shtei Moav. Now, Moav, interestingly, is the same agriculture and climate as Beit Lechem. So everyone asks, well, why is it helpful to go to Moav? It's the same agriculture. And then again, no names. So I'd like to deal with just these five psukim. I'd like to raise a few questions. But first, I want to give what I think is a very important background to this whole story. And that is, what is the period of Shoftim all about? To sum it up, the period of the Shoftim, of the judges, is an abysmal time. It's terrible. After the Torah ends, we get to say for Yehoshua. Yehoshua is actually a pretty good period for Bnei Israel. They conquer most of the land. It's very positive. There are a few slip-ups here or there, but by the end of it, Bnei Israel does a pretty good job. There are some cracks, but overall, it's a very solid time. It's a time that's mostly successful. And then Perek Chavdal, Yehuda, Yehoshua finishes off. He dies. And then we begin Sefer Shoftim. Already from the first pasuk of Sefer Shoftim, things go downhill. It's already, they're supposed to, Yehuda is supposed to go up. They don't appoint Yehuda as a leader. Already in the first chapter, we don't have them conquering all the land that they're supposed to. So the cracks in society begin already then. And then it continues. And it gets to the point, and this is obviously very broad scope, we can discuss this more at length later, but just it gets to the point where they end up having the worst civil war in Jewish history, where they almost wipe out an entire tribe. They build basically like an alternate Beis HaMikdash, sort of, Pesel Micha. They have a case which is similar to Sodom, which we'll deal with in a second. It's a total breakdown of society. It's religious breakdown, social breakdown. It's terrible. It's an abysmal period. And then we get to Sefer Shmuel afterwards. So that's just in terms of what is going on in terms of the time of Shoftim. Three questions on, now let's go back. Three questions on these psukim that I want to talk about. We assume, right, if we read in one pasuk that he goes down, he leaves Eretz Yisrael, and then two psukim later he dies, we assume that there's some sort of sin here, right? Elimelech, we're all taught that there's some sort of sin, because why does he die so quickly? Now, my question to you is the following, right? Where is that sin? Right? You read these psukim, you can't pin down exactly where the sin is, right? Everyone knows there's a sin, but you read it at just at its chat level, at a very simple reading, not clear what the sin would be, okay? That's one. We'll get back into that in a second. Question number two. Why isn't this book in Shoftim? Why isn't Rut part of Shoftim? Rut is four chapters, right? Shoftim is 21 chapters. wouldn't have hurt the printer so much to add this book there. It's just four more chapters. And Shoftim is a lot of individual stories. So it would have fit, you know, it could have fit totally fine in that genre. So why not just add this to Sefer Shoftim? Why is it its own book? Then the last thing I want to say is, okay, so you told us it's in the time period of Shoftim. How long is the period of Shoftim? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It's between, 2000 and 2010. This is a tremendously long period, and it doesn't tell us at all when this actually occurred. And if you look, and we'll do this for just a moment, and I think just to highlight the point, there's at least five different approaches to when this actually took place. It's unbelievable. If you look at source number 10, it says famously, probably the most famous date for the story of Boaz, for the story of Elimelech. When was this? Ubiyimei, source number 10, Ubiyimei Ivtsan Haya. So it was in the time of Ivtsan. How do we know this? Because Chazal say, Ivtsan ze Boaz. Ivtsan is Boaz. Okay? Ivtsan, there are three psukim about in the entirety of Sefer Shoftim. Not a lot of information. It's in Perek Yudbet, the 12th chapter of Sefer Shoftim. Sometimes Midrashim do this where they try to just pin down, okay, we have a character which doesn't say a lot about, so we'll just figure out how to pin it down on someone. Well, I'll try to argue maybe at the very end of our series is there's a little more going on there. Malbim, second answer, says there was no special judge at that time. It was a bunch of judges, so that's why it doesn't give us the time of a specific judge. Answer number two. Answer number three, it was at the time of Barak and Devorah. Barak and Devorah are chapters 4 and 5 in Shoftim, right? Then next answer there, Shamgar ve'Ehud, which is the second and third chapters of Shoftim. And then others say it was all the way at the end of Shoftim. So we see there's no clear date at all in this book. My question is why? Why doesn't it give a date? And I think the answer to the question regarding why isn't this in Shoftim and why doesn't it give a clear date is one and the same. Namely, and this is going to be a key theme for us, the Book of Rut is supposed to be a response, a remedy to the perils of the Jewish people in Shoftim. The struggles, the despair that Bnei Israel ends up being in at the very end of Shoftim, that's what Rut is supposed to respond to. That's what it's supposed to remedy. Those very same social problems and religious problems. And the point is that even if you could find a specific date, even if you could pin it down on some time in Shoftim, maybe you could say, oh, it's the time of Gidon, some of the same details. The point is that the book is trying to tell you, Bimei Shvot HaShoftim. It's trying to challenge the entire Sefer of Shoftim. It's the book of Shoftim, and Rut is coming to be a response to that book. And we'll see that throughout the Sefer, there are all these parallels to Shoftim. I also think that's why it can't be in the book. Right, if it was part of the book of Shoftim, then it would be part of that history. But the whole point is it needs to be outside of it. It needs to be able to respond to the book of Shoftim. And that's why it's not together. Interestingly, in the Greek, in the Targum HaShivim, which is one of the translations of the Torah, they actually have Shoftim, then Rut, and then Sefer Shmuel. Meaning Shoftim is what, meaning Rut is supposed to be what takes Bnei Yisrael from Shoftim to a time of Shmuel, to a time of more tranquility, to a time of a king. And that's what we're going to try to develop, and that's going to be our meta theme, which everything is going to loop into, which is that how Rut is responding to the ills of society in Shoftim. We'll leave the third question I asked, which is, why isn't there a description of Elimelech's sin? Right, everyone assumes that there's a sin of Elimelech. Why is that the case? Take a look at the first pasuk, first two psukim again. What could he have done wrong? So what does he do? So there's a famine in the land, and he goes to Moab. Who else leaves Eretz Yisrael when there's a famine in the land? Say it again. Anybody know who else leaves Eretz Yisrael to go down somewhere else? Avram Avinu. Avram leaves Eretz Israel twice. He leaves Israel twice to go down to Mitzrayim. And who else goes down? Yaakov, the end of Bereishis, right? So going down, leaving Eretz Israel itself inherently is not necessarily a problem, right? So not clear that that's an issue. He goes to Moab and his two sons, gives us some description, and then tells us he dies. So there are all these clues as to why there might have been a problem. There are a lot of clues, right? There are some clues as in the first pasuk, it doesn't say his name, meaning it says Ish, Ish. It shows that he's a big deal. Maybe that means he was a leader who abandoned his people during that time. It could be that he was leaving his land to go to the enemy. Ra'av here doesn't mean a Ra'av from a drought. It means Ra'av because another nation attacked them. There was they stole all their food. And then maybe he goes to Moab, who stole all their food, and maybe he goes there and joins them. So he goes to the enemy's territory. So it could be that that's the problem. Some say just the act of leaving Eretz Yisrael itself is a problem. But we said it's not clear that that's the issue. And there's a final suggestion, which is that maybe he just didn't want to give food to everyone else. He was a rich man, wanted to avoid giving food, and therefore what does he do? He leaves to Moab so he can avoid having to give handouts to people. But then again, there's no clear sin here. And that I think is just a very obvious question that I'd like to leave aside for just a moment. I want to conclude with the following topic. And that is the Milat Hamanche, the guiding word, or as Buber called the light word, in the first parak of Megillat Ruth. If you look at this chapter, there's one word which comes up over and over again. So if you think about what happens in this chapter, and we'll go more into it next week, but basically what happens is Machlo and Kilion, the two sons, die, Elimelech dies, and then Naomi goes back to her land, goes back to Beit Lechem. And then Ruth and Orpah decide to go with her. Right, they try to argue, let us go with you. And Naomi initially is very upset about this. So if you look, Naomi says, no, you're not going with me, over and over again. She tells them to stay back. If you look here, she tells them quite strongly to stay back, actually. She says, thank you very much. Thank you for all your kindness to me, that you did to my children and to me. Go back, get married, go to your parents' house. And she does this three times. And we'll go into this a little bit more next week, but here we're just trying to give a little bit of an introduction to the book. She does this three times. And the first time, Ruth and Orpah, the other daughter-in-law, they both refuse. And the second time, Orpah gives in. She says, Batishak Orpah lechamota v'Ruth davka ba. So Orpah leaves, she goes back to Moab, but Ruth sticks with her. And then the third time, she says, go back. And Ruth famously says, Amech ami elokai elokai, your nation is my nation, your God is my God, I'm sticking with you, I'm coming back with you. And then they go back to Beit Lechem. Now, there's a parallel, or let's say not even just a parallel, but there's a theme that has bothered or has intrigued a lot of writers for quite a while, which is, what's the relationship between Ruth's ancestral roots and the story that we are reading here now? So where's Ruth from? Moab. Now, where's Moab descended from? Any suggestions?
Lot.
Right, so Ruth is descended from Lot. So let's just take a second to review the story of Lot. And this is going to be, I find this fascinating. What happens with Lot? Okay, Lot and Avraham. Lot goes with Avraham. He goes away from his father. Even he goes with Avraham Avinu, and they travel together around. And eventually, it hits a point where Lot and Avraham can no longer stick together, at least seemingly. Okay, Lot's shepherds and Avraham's shepherds are having some sort of strife. They're having some sort of conflict. The psukim say, and Avraham says to Lot the following. He says, I'll share with you the psukim exactly. He says, right over here. So he says, Ki Hashem, so he says, Alti miriva b'ni u'b'neich, let's not have a big fight. U'b'ne roi between my shepherds and your shepherds. Ki Hashem achim anachmi, because we're brothers. He says, You go, a local arts of Anafa, you parade now, may alive, the whole land is in front of us. Let's keep parade, let's split off from each other. If I go, if you know, you'll go left, I'll go right. If you'll go right, I'll go left. And what does Lot do? So Lot, instead of Avram says, you know, he goes right. What does he choose? He chooses to go straight, Lot, right? Lot ignores Avram's suggestion, he goes straight. Now, where does Lot go? Anybody remember? Lot goes to Sodom, famously. And then the question is, how are we supposed to view Lot going to Sodom? Is that inherently proud? Does Lot go there just because I'm done with Avram, you know, I'm done with the kindness, I'm done with all that? Or does Lot go there for other reasons? So Rashi famously says he wanted away from Hashem. He said, I'm done with this loving kindness. I'm going somewhere where I could have some immorality, where I can avoid this type of social responsibility. That's the traditional reading I think some of us are familiar with. But just from a simple reading of the verses, Lot actually doesn't abandon Abraham's values, right? Actually, the Radak says, Lot goes there and thinks that I'm so strong in my emunah. I'm so strong in my belief and my how upright I am. I'm not going to learn from Sodom. He's not going there because he wants to be part of Sodom. He's going there because, oh, it's a nice, fruitful land. I'll go there and I'll be myself. And the truth is, he actually tries to do that. Because what happens with Lot? Avraham Avinu has guests. And the next chapter, who has guests? I think next chapter, Lot. Lot has guests as well. And he actually treats them pretty nicely. And the question is, now what happens to Lot afterwards? Lot has good intentions, perhaps even. Lot tries to have guests over. But what ends up happening? So if you look at the Psukim, what happens is that Sodom comes, and Sodom basically barges down his door, and they say to him, give us your guests. Right? He says, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we may be intimate with them. So they want to basically bring these men out so they could rape them, the guests that Lot is having. And what does Lot do? Lot gives out his daughters, right? Which is like a shocking thing to do to us. Right, that Lot is going to give out his own daughters for the sake of his guests. So we see that there's this act of kindness with very good intentions, but it ends up being perverted into something kind of totally the antithesis to kindness. You're going to throw your own daughters out onto the street. That's the first thing that happens. Okay, his acts of kindness get corrupted. The second thing that happens with Lot, what's the other sort of tragedy? Lot, after Sodom is all destroyed, he ends up cohabiting with his daughters because they think no one else is alive. Lot ends up having descendants with his own daughters, like the peak of sexual immorality. He's producing children with his own family, and those two daughters, those kids are who? Ammon and Moab. And where does Ruth come from? Moab. And the idea that some develop, Rav Meidan, Dr. Ziegler, and others, is that even though Lot had good intentions, the fact that he went down to Sodom ties his fate to Sodom. He thinks, I can go to Sodom and I can be myself. I can follow the values, the path of Avram Avinu. But the truth is, once Lot decides to go to Sodom, he's tying himself up to that for eternity. He can't change the culture there. He's going to get impacted by that. And we see that even his good intentions get corrupted. Now, those two things that get corrupted, right? The act of kindness and the act of sexual promiscuity. If you think about Moab later on, what are the two problems that Moab has later on? What are the two things that they do wrong? Anybody know? Danny, what are the two? I see Danny over there, so I could pick on him. Danny, where do we know Moab, the Moabites from later on?
In the desert, they wouldn't give B'nai Israel water or food.
Exactly. Right. So one thing is that they fail in terms of kindness. Right. We're not allowed to have Moabite men in the community of Israel. Why? Because they fail in kindness. Right. That's the Midah. That's a characteristic of Sodom. Lot goes to Sodom, thinks he's going to be able to be kind. Unfortunately, that can't happen. He gets tied up in Sodom. And therefore, his kids end up being the antithesis of kindness. They don't give B'nai Israel bread on their way out of Egypt. Okay? That's the first thing. What's the other thing that happens? So Avram Avinu always tries to stay separate from Canaan, from the sexual immorality of Canaan. What happens with Lot, Lot's descendants? Right? Lot, we know, is now sexually promiscuous with his children, with his daughters. Now, what happens to Lot's kids? What's the other thing we know about Moab? Danny, help us out here.
Bilam.
Exactly. After Bilam fails, basically, what happens is that the Moabite woman seduced Bnei Israel. So the other issue that happens with Lot also happens with his kids, the type of sexual promiscuity. In Sefer Bamidbar, Bilam tries to curse Bnei Israel. He's unsuccessful. And so they successfully have the Moabite woman to go and be promiscuous with the Jews, and they're able to seduce them. Now, we see that these two traits of Lot, these two traits that corrupted what Avraham Avinu is all about, loving kindness and staying separate from all other nations. Avraham Avinu won't even take a gift of Maran Machpelah because he wants to stay separate and not to be involved with the promiscuity of the other nations. Those two themes, right, are what Moab is all about, okay? And what does Ruth decide to do? So if you look at the Psukim here, and this is just fascinating, Ruth is meant to be the return, the remedy for Lot. Ruth is doing tshuva for Lot. She's doing repentance. Where am I getting this from? Where am I getting this from that there's some sort of element of tshuva here? What am I talking about? So if you look at the light word, the milat mancha, the guiding word in this whole chapter, what is that word that comes up over and over and over again? 12 times in one chapter is the word shav. So you look here, shav, shav. Over and over and over again, this notion of return appears. It's this type of tshuva. And so I think that the whole theme of this chapter is tshuva. It's a type of tshuva for Lot. It's a type of return, a remedy for Lot, that his descendant now goes back to the ways of Avraham Avinu and joins with the nation of Israel. She's joining with Avraham. And that's one of the main themes. It's a remedying the social ills of Sodom, the social ills, the problems of Moab, and she's turning back to the path of Avraham. Just to prove this point and then to conclude with one other. If you look at this chart here that I put together, you'll see this point played out exactly. When we talk about Avraham and Lot, right? What's the most famous pasuk by Avraham? How we know he's a servant of God initially. Hashem says to Avraham, Lech lecha me'artzecha me'ulatecha me'beit avicha. Leave from your land, your place of birth, and from the house of your father, El ha'aretz asher arecha, to the land that I show you. What does it say in Rut? Second parak, when it's referring to Rut's actions, V'tazvi avich v'imech. You left your fathers and mother and your mother, right? Same thing as avich. V'eretz moladetech, and the house of your birthplace. V'telchi, just like lech lecha. So here, Boaz, when he's describing Rut, is describing Rut in the same terms that Avraham Avinu is described. That's point number one. That I think is clear, that it's a reference to Rut is being connected to Avraham. Second point is, by the Lot story, it says, Halokal arts benacha, he parade. Separate yourself from me, Avram says to Lot. What does Rut say to Naomi, who's acting as the Avram figure here, the Jew that Rut is trying to stick to? Ki amavet yafrid. Only death will do us part. I'm going to stick with you forever. Rut is saying, I'm tying myself to the Jewish tradition, the Jewish history. I'm tying myself to that, and I'm joining your community of loving kindness, your community of morality. And finally, and I think this is really interesting, by the Akedah, how does the Torah describe Avram and Yitzchak? By Yachush Nehem Yachdav, the two of them walk together. By Rut, how does it describe Rut and Naomi going together to Beit Lechem? Batelachna Shtehem, the two of them walk together. The similar formulation, numerous people have pointed this out, Ramidan, one of them. The idea being is that Rut is connected, she's tying herself to Naomi. She's attaching herself to her because Naomi is bringing her back to Eretz Yisrael, bringing her back to the path of Avraham Avinu. And what I said before is that I think the whole book of, one other point, when the Pasuk in Rut describes Rut going back to Beit Lechem, with Naomi going back, it refers to Rut as going back as well. But Tashav Naomi Rutam Uviya Kalata Ima. So Rut, Naomi returned, and Rut, her daughter-in-law, Hashava Miste Moab, her daughter-in-law, who returned from Moab to Eretz Yisrael. Now, how could Rut have returned from Moab? That doesn't make any sense, right? Ruth's never been to Beit Lechem, right? She's not part of Israel. But if we understand it in light of this idea that Ruth is a return from Lot and a return from what's going on in Moab, then it actually makes a lot more sense, right? Because what is Ruth doing? Ruth is doing this tshuva for Lot. She's returning to where she's supposed to be. She's returning to Avram Avinu. And I want to end with this thought, because this is sort of a little bit of an insight into what we're going to try to be discussing throughout the series. If there's one place or there's one story in all of Tanakh that represents Sodom the most, that represents the immorality of Sodom to the greatest extent, what story is that? Has anyone here, if anyone here has learned Shoftim, Perek Yotet of Sefer Shoftim, there's one story there that is the essence of what is going on in Sodom. Anybody know what I'm referring to?
Pilagish Begiva.
Pilagish Begiva. At the end of Sefer Shoftim, there's a story there that linguistically, thematically, in terms of the storyline, completely parallels what's going on in Sodom. B'nai Israel has abandoned the path of Abraham in Shoftim and has gone to the path of Sodom. And what Ruth is doing is she's not only, you know, returning from Lot, she's sort of teaching B'nai Israel as well how to return from the path of Sodom, as they demonstrate in Pilagus Begiva, and we'll explore this much more at length later on. It's Ruth's teaching B'nai Israel how to return from the path of Lot, the path of Moab, the path of Sodom, and how to return to the path of Abraham. And so this is one of a small example of the theme that we're going to try to develop, which is how Ruth is a response to Shoftim. It's supposed to repair the ills of Shoftim, where they've abandoned the path of Abraham, and to bring us back to a place where God can dwell among them, where God, where they could have a king leading them, and to repair the problems that they have in society. And I look forward to doing that together. If anyone has any comments or questions, my email is av.r.wine@gmail.com. You can email me there, or you have my number. Please be in touch, and I enjoyed this very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.